This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Youssef Ibrahim, has traveled throughout the Arab world for his work as Middle East regional correspondent for the New York Times. Last week, we spoke with him about the transition to Palestinian rule in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and why Palestinians are growing increasingly disillusioned with Yasser Arafat. Coming up in part two of our conversation, we talk about Ibrahim's experiences as an Arab American covering the Arab world. Ibrahim was born in Cairo and is a graduate of the American University there and the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism in New York. He's won a George Polk Award and the Overseas Press Club Award. I asked him to elaborate on something he recently wrote in the Times about a new change in Arab thinking. He wrote, "More and more commentators have stopped blaming outside conspirators for Arab problems. The new message in Arab intellectual circles is that the Arab world must learn to negotiate differences because this ideology of all or nothing at all has cost too much."
Well, this is the most remarkable evolution in Arab thinking, in my opinion, since World War II. In many ways, it started with the Gulf War. Because the Gulf War simply showed that there is no united Arab world, and that half the Arab world was sort of on a socialist development track, the other half was on about as capitalist as they come development track. And there was really all these differences have been ignored, and all the differences have been accumulating, and in many ways they exploded during the Gulf War. The Gulf War pitted everybody against everybody. So beneath all of this, the Arab intelligentsia had never died. I mean, the great centers of Arab civilizations, Egypt, Damascus, Baghdad, were producing writers and thinkers and columnists who've been questioning over the past 10 years whether we got it right. I mean, what happened to Arab nationalism? What happened to this conflict with Israel? Is this rational? And the other thing, of course, is that the Arab Gulf War made it absolutely clear that dictators are a total catastrophe. Not only Saddam Hussein, but Saddam Hussein and other dictators you wouldn't dare to mention by name. But you'd sit in a dinner in Arab intelligentsia group house home these days, and you'd hear things like awful things about Hafez Assad, awful things about Muammar Gaddafi, awful things about King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, things that people, you know, didn't dare articulate and get into very clearly before. So yes, there is now a number of new beliefs. And in fact, it's a very hopeful development. I mean, it's the most exciting thing in the Arab world, that finally people are speaking out. Finally, they are asking questions about the Arab condition and basically saying we want to join the larger democratic process in the world.
So is it easier now for Arab intellectuals to break ranks and think independently and criticize?
It is, and the momentum is almost unstoppable. Of course, there's a downside to this, because also the momentum of the Islamic fundamentalist movement is unstoppable, and it's part of this explosion of, if you like, free thinking and free expression.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, you're talking about two absolutely opposing forces that are blossoming at the same time, Islamic fundamentalists and free-thinking Arab intellectuals. So, and you've got the Islamists trying to stop intellectual questioning. I mean, a lot of the Islamists want to take over the education system.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of denouncing now of the arts and of popular culture.
But you see, the Islamic fundamentalism is really a continuation of the things we've been talking about, this sort of completely dictatorial, totalitarian society where everybody has got to think the same way. This is just chapter two of the previous totalitarian dictatorial societies in which everybody has had to think the same way, except the other one was called Arab nationalism and Arab socialism. And if you broke rank with this, you were a traitor, you were a Western stooge, you were an agent, and so on and so forth. Islamic fundamentalism has picked things right there and continues to take them, except it's put a new label on them. It's called the Quran, Islam. In the name of God, you cannot think. In the name of God, you have to dress this way. In the name of God, you got to eat this way. In the name of God, you cannot read this, or you cannot hear this, or you cannot see that. In the name of God, you have got to struggle against Israel forever. And the liberal establishment is the other establishment, which says, hey, wait a minute, this is completely crazy. We have to join the rest of the world.
My guest is Youssef Ibrahim, regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with New York Times correspondent Youssef Ibrahim. I'm interested in the range of reactions you get from people, both at the government level and individuals who you're talking to, when you tell them that you are a reporter with the New York Times. What are some of the attitudes toward the paper?
Well, some of the reaction is the same, you know, if you'd ask my colleague in Bangkok or in India or South Africa, you probably get the same answer. It will be the New York Times is always seen outside as the manifestation, the reflection of the American ruling establishment. So in some ways you are carrying this heavy burden, which is a bit true, but you and I know is not completely true. I mean, there are many other papers, and this is a country where there is a free press. On the other hand, we are the best newspaper in the country. So, and possibly even on a global basis, I mean, without exaggerating. And people know that. I'm not kidding. I mean, people think the New York Times is really speaking for America and for the Western world. In the Arab world, of course, there's the added dimension that we are the establishment of the ruling establishment newspaper of the country that is supporting and has supported unconditionally and completely Israel for the last 45 years. So that adds a little bit of an ugly, confrontational dimension here. Having said that, of course, most of the people in the Arab world that I cover, and in Israel, because I covered that too, and in Iran, which I cover as well, know that the press and the media that they have is garbage, and it is a collection of lies, and it is a propaganda tool, and they know that we are not. So there is a grudging respect.
In Tom Friedman's book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, which was his chronicle of covering the Arab world and Israel, he wrote that when he was assigned to cover Israel, it broke the New York Times' unwritten rule against having a Jew cover Israel. And I'm wondering if there was ever a similar unwritten rule about having an Arab reporter cover the Arab world.
I don't know what rule there is. It's a delicate subject. I don't think we really discussed it this way. But I did think that when I was hired by the New York Times in 1976, I was hired by Abe Rosenthal, who was then the executive editor. He did break a rule. I don't believe that in the big establishment, American media, that there were people who thought you can bring in an American Arab, let's put it that way, to cover the Middle East. And I think at that time it wasn't even considered like this. I mean, nobody sat down and said, gee, this is Noah's boat and we have every kind, so why don't we get ourselves an American Arab? I think the obsession at the time was, we got to have some Arab speaker, It may have taken a life of its own after this, but I think, let's put it this way, the debate which Tom raised in his book by saying an American Jew covering the Middle East, an American Jew, in fact, covering Israel, was much more advanced than the other side of the equation. After all, Arab Americans are still sort of a minority to which not too much attention is being paid.
Are you ever criticized among Arab people who you cover for airing dirty laundry in public?
Of course, I am. But I'm also criticized among, I think, American Jews who feel perhaps I shouldn't be there in the first place. And but the criticism, you are right, among the Arabs is there. I wouldn't want to give it too much importance because most of the people I deal with in the Arab world are, in my opinion, intelligent people. And sophisticated people. And you got to remember that the Arab world has come a long way in the last 25 years just because of petrodollars. I mean, it has evolved tremendously.
Now, I know you were born in Cairo in 1943. You studied at the Columbia School of Journalism after attending the American University in Cairo. Why did you want to go to Columbia? And I'm interested in why you wanted to become a reporter. Like, what inspired you to become a
reporter? Is very simple. I went to the movies when I was 13. I saw something called Love is a Many Splendid Things, which was William Holden, Jennifer Johnson. He was a correspondent who covering the Korean War. I saw the film about 7 times. So that is very simple. There was never any doubt there. And then I did the journalism. I was the campus newspaper editor. I mean, I really didn't think about anything except journalism. So that's why I wanted to be a reporter.
Was the press a pretty free press when you were growing up in Egypt?
It was a very interesting and very rich press, which most people don't realize. Egypt, that may sound chauvinistic since I am from Egypt, of course, but it is really the birthplace of Arab civilization. And the Egypt I grew up in was a leftist, socialist, and intellectually very vibrant society of journalistic society. At a time where, as you know, in this period, the 50s, 60s, 70s, the leftist cause was thriving around the world. So you had the benefit, really, of a lot of fine writing and fine thinking. If I say what kind of writing, what kind of thinking shaped my generation, I would say definitely socialist, slightly Marxist, heavily leftist leaning in general, and progressive in orientation before, of course, the big disappointment was all of these things. So it was a thriving, writing, journalistic society.
Were your parents intellectuals?
And my parents were sort of upper middle class. My father was a businessman. He was the manager of a big department store, like Bloomingdale or something like this. My mother is just a very wonderful lady who played piano and was a housewife.
Okay.
But I had and still have my favorite uncle, who was an irremediable Marxist. and who has played a tremendous influence in making me read and think. And he was sort of, and still is, the resident intellectual of the family.
You're based in Paris, but you're covering
That's
the
Middle
East.
That's a very technical definition.
Yeah.
And before I came here, I said that if a single senior editor says to me, "How's Paris?" I'm going to blow up because
you're never there.
This year, until this moment I'm talking to you, I've spent a total of 48 nights in Paris. The rest was on the road. So I'm based really on an airplane.
Hectic.
A bit too hectic, but it's fun.
Youssef Ibrahim is regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. This is Fresh Air.